Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from the Santa Clara Marriott. I am Justice Ming Shin. I'm an Associate Justice of the California Supreme Court, a past president of the Commonwealth Club. It is my pleasure to be your chair for today. At this time, we would like to acknowledge and thank the Toby Family American Value Series for supporting today's program. We are joined today by U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who was sworn in as the nation's 80th Attorney General on February 3, 2005. His career in public service includes a number of leadership positions in the state of Texas and as White House counsel to President George W. Bush. Since becoming the nation's highest-ranking law enforcement officer, Attorney General Gonzalez has focused the Justice Department on a number of top priorities, including preventing terrorism, reducing violent crime, drug use, cybercrime, and protecting our civil rights. He is the grandson of immigrants. Attorney General Gonzalez grew up in Texas and still considers that his home. On a personal aside, Mr. Attorney General, we have one thing in common. We both come from families of 8 children. He is a veteran of the United States Air Force, a graduate of Rice University and Harvard Law School. With his position, he recognizes the great promise and opportunities for our nation and believes that every American should have the opportunity to achieve their full potential in a society based on justice and the rule of law. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez.
Good morning, and thank you, Judge, for that generous welcome, and thank you all for having me as a guest today. I want to talk to you about immigration. I suspect we'll be talking about other subjects this morning, but the subject that I want to speak about as an initial matter is immigration, which is something that's very close to my heart for a number of reasons. We all have our own perspective on the issue because of our heritage, our profession, our proximity to the border, and so on. Now, that said, I believe that we can all agree on at least one fact and one answer when it comes to immigration. And the fact is that the federal government needs to take action. And the answer is that there are no easy answers. But that's all right. I'm proud to support the president's proposal for immigration reform in part because it isn't an easy answer. It's a broad set of reforms that address the problem of illegal immigration from every relevant angle. Security at the border, a temporary worker program, effective identification systems that will ease employer accountability, and a course of action for the million of illegal immigrants who are already here in our great country. I believe that it is a comprehensive set of reforms that will work together to address a considerable and growing problem, and it is a growing problem. And I hope that by the end of our time together that you'll agree. But since my own background and profession lend me a unique perspective on immigration and immigration reform, I'd like to share them briefly with you. I think it will provide a good starting point for our discussion. I was raised very cognizant of the fact that my grandparents chose this country as a place where they could make a better life for their children and grandchildren. They were born Mexicans, but they chose to live as Americans. In the process, they instilled in their children and grandchildren a deep-seated patriotism. Their dreams of a better life in this country were realized and even exceeded after just 2 generations. I'm humbled to realize that I am the product of their American dreams. And this influences my views on immigration in the sense that I am a passionate believer in the melting pot. I very much like the fact the United States of America is a nation of immigrants, and I believe that our diversity gives us strength. Beyond being the product of immigration, my views have been shaped by my experience as an attorney, a judge, and as the Attorney General, the nation's top law enforcement official. I am ever mindful that we are a nation of laws, and the enforcement of these laws is critical to our country's health and the preservation of its freedoms. And I know that illegal immigration degrades the rule of law. I appreciate that your perspective on the issue is unique as well. You are Californians. You have the largest population of illegal immigrants in the country. Many of you are employers. All of you are taxpayers. These factors have all shaped your views, no doubt. You've also had more years to think about the problem and the potential solutions than many of our fellow Americans because the issue reached critical mass here long ago. Immigrants, illegal and legal, have provided a critical supply of labor, particularly for California's agricultural and tech industries. Both legal and illegal immigrants have contributed to your tax base. But illegal immigrants also represent an enormous cost to your state in the form of social services, education, medical care, and so on. And then to the decades-long California concern over immigration, a new red flag appeared 5 years ago, terrorism. A porous border is now an opportunity for the enemies of this country to enter, blend in, and develop their plots on American soil. So for California, and now for the rest of the nation, reform cannot come soon enough. For this complicated, emotional, and alarming issue, government action must be fair, just, and realistic. Let's start with the value of fairness. 2 weeks ago, just after the 4th of July, I participated in a naturalization ceremony for new American citizens in New York City. I don't know how many of you have seen friends or family members naturalize. It is quite moving. I reassured these proud new citizens that the president is committed to fairness in his reform agenda. The president and I believe that morally, those of us in government owe it to them, the people who follow the rules to become citizens, to enact smart reform that acknowledges the difference between those who follow the rules and those who did not. It is only fair. That includes going to the back of the line for citizenship if you are here illegally. It includes paying substantial fines, paying back income taxes, and paying back Social Security taxes. Most illegal immigrants who have been living and working here for a long time have been productive and otherwise law-abiding members of our society. Allowing them a chance at citizenship is fair, but it must be earned. And the price of breaking the law must be paid. Like anything that is earned, citizenship will be especially cherished by those who work for it. For those who came here illegally, immigration reform will make the road to citizenship harder and longer. There's no question about that, but it will not be out of reach. Again, this is a fair and practical solution to the challenge facing all Americans, including those who seek or have already achieved citizenship legally. Now, reform must also be just and renew faith in the rule of law. Giving honest immigrants a lawful way to provide for their families will bring the rule of law back to an underground sector of the labor market. Willing workers would be matched with willing employers. All applicants would need to pass criminal background checks, and temporary workers would be required to return to their home countries at the end of their work contract. Now, we believe that a well-designed and well-run temporary worker program will be good for state and local governments because temporary workers would be taxpayers, contributing to the funding of social services, education, and health care. Part of what will make a temporary worker program function well is a better identification system. Employer accountability is essential in our efforts to restore integrity to the nation's immigration system. And while knowingly hiring illegal immigrants is flouting the law, we must recognize that it can be difficult for employers to verify their worker status. Document fraud is widespread and it is extremely sophisticated. It is an international crime business that is on par with the structure and scope of major drug cartels. So a well-forged document is not easily identified by an untrained eye. And of course, for most employers, their area of expertise is not document verification. It's farming or manufacturing or whatever their business is. Every day, employers are presented with false Social Security cards, birth certificates, driver's license, resident alien cards, etc. Some of these would-be workers have fully stolen the identity of an American citizen. Again, employers are not document detectives, and they are not required to be under law. In fact, they risk lawsuits if they reject a potential employee whose documents reasonably appear to be valid. Small firms, in particular, lack the resources to verify documentation. In other words, they don't have a human resources department to look into these matters. The Department of Homeland Security is moving forward on a number of fronts to give employers the tools they need to develop a secure, legal workforce. But to help employers out and to crack down on this problem over the long term, we should eventually create a new identification card for every legal foreign worker. We have the technology for this, and we must use it. Digital fingerprints, for example, could make an ID card tamper-proof. This would help enforce the law and leave employers with no excuse for violating it. Easily enforced laws also have the power to modify incentives. If foreign workers know they can only work here under legitimate circumstances with official identification, there will be less incentive for them to cross the border illegally. Finally, reforms must be based in reality. For example, we cannot realistically deport en masse the 12 million people who are here illegally today. A strictly defined path to citizenship involving the required payment of fees and back taxes, as I described a moment ago, flatly makes more sense. The president has said that illegal immigrants who have roots in our country and want to stay should have to pay a meaningful penalty for breaking the law. He wants them to pay their taxes and learn English. He thinks they should wait in line behind those who played by the rules and followed the law. I know there is concern about amnesty, but I want to reassure you that the president's plan is a way for those who have broken the law to pay their debt to society and then have a chance to demonstrate their character and their commitment to achieving legal citizenship. This is not amnesty. Those who have come here illegally in order to engage in illegal or illicit activities, including terrorism plots, are in another category. And they have the Department of Justice, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and state and local enforcement officials to deal with. We are working together to discover, dismantle, and disrupt their conspiracies every single day. As I told the Senate Judiciary Committee earlier this week, when it comes to a passion for disrupting homegrown terrorism plots, for the employees of the Department of Justice, every day is like September 12th. Their dedication is 100% every day. This leads me to my next point about reality. We could not ignore the reality that the level of ease with which foreigners can enter our country illegally is a security threat. We can still take pride in being an open country and a nation of immigrants, while also protecting our country from those who seek to harm us, whether through taking advantage of our social services without contributing to the tax base, through selling illegal drugs that destroy families and communities, or through plotting and carrying out acts of terror. Successfully securing our borders will take manpower, the implementation of technology, the end of the practice of catch and release, and a dedication at all levels of government, local, state, and federal, to keeping the criminals out, period. The president does not want to militarize the borders, but he has called on Congress to provide funding for dramatic improvements. By the end of 2008, he hopes to increase the number of Border Patrol officers by 6,000. This will mean that the size of the Border Patrol will have more than doubled during his presidency. As you know, the president has also deployed the National Guard to help out until permanent Border Patrol officers can be hired and trained. I hope that you'll agree that these actions demonstrate a solid commitment to increase border security. And while manpower is being deployed, the most technologically advanced border security initiatives in our history must also be launched. This includes high-tech fences in urban corridors and new patrol roads and barriers in rural areas. We have the technology, and we must use it to enhance the efforts of our Border Patrol officers. Motion sensors, infrared cameras, and unmanned aerial vehicles will all help out in doing their jobs and ultimately help prevent illegal crossings. This is another area where government action must be in partnership. State and local law enforcement needs our support, and under the President's proposal, they will get it. That means increased federal funding for state and local authorities who are assisting the Border Patrol on targeted enforcement missions. It also means providing specialized training so they can help federal officers apprehend and detain illegal immigrants. I mentioned ending the practice of catch and release. This is important in terms of both justice and reality. When we catch illegal immigrants crossing the border, they've got to be returned to their home countries. This has been logistically easier with illegal immigrants from Mexico. But those from other countries presented us with physical and legal challenges. Unfortunately, for many years, we did not have enough space and detention facilities to hold these people while the legal process took its course. They were therefore released into society and asked to return for a court date. I don't think it will come as a surprise to hear that the vast majority have not shown up for their court dates. This practice is simply unacceptable, and worse, it mocks the efforts of our Border Patrol officers who apprehend the illegal border crossers in the first place. The end of catch and release will be the beginning of an overall more effective border security program. And steps are already underway in this area. We are adding beds and detention facilities and have expedited the legal process to cut the average deportation time. And we're letting foreign governments know, in no uncertain terms, that they must accept back their citizens who violate U.S. immigration laws. The President is asking Congress for additional funding and legal authority to end catch and release at the southern border once and for all. We believe that this will provide another change in incentives. When people know that they will be caught and sent home if they enter our country illegally, they will be less likely to try to sneak in. The reality of the times calls for fast, no-nonsense action, and the values we hold dear as a nation call for justice and fairness at all times. I believe the President's plan strikes a very good balance of these objectives. The freedom and opportunity afforded by the United States of America has always attracted and will always attract hopeful souls yearning to be free. This is a good thing, and it must continue. A nation of immigrants is something we should preserve because we know immigration enriches our country enormously. We are also a nation of laws, and that helps make our country strong as well. The goal of immigration reform, as well as with all good legislation, is to protect what we value most while keeping pace with changing times, circumstances, and challenges. I believe this can be done through the President's proposed reforms. As leaders in this state, and your communities, I encourage you to voice your opinion and give input on this issue. All aspects of the debate deserve attention because reform that is anything short of comprehensive will not be good enough. And so please stay engaged. This President's plan is big. It is not simple because there are no simple answers to a challenge of this magnitude. But I assure you that a comprehensive bill will mean comprehensive victory for state and local governments, for taxpayers, and for both economic and homeland security of the American people. When he talks about this issue, the President reminds those of us in government that real lives will be affected by our debates and decisions. As a member of his cabinet, I can speak to the fact that his policies are smart and well thought out. But as his friend, I can speak to his dedication to human dignity. And I can tell you that that is something that has helped shape his immigration reform proposals. The President appreciates that people are willing to risk everything, everything for the dream of freedom. And he appreciates the vital need to protect Americans from those who will do anything to take our freedoms away. I believe his reform proposals are an excellent, multifaceted approach to this very delicate, very complicated issue. Again, thank you so much for having me here today to talk about immigration reform, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Attorney General Gonzalez. My name is Mary Cranston. I am the chair of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, and I will be asking the questions of the Attorney General that have come up from all of you. So Without further ado, let me begin. One question, Attorney General Gonzales, is the difference between the President's current proposal and the versions of the Senate bill and House bill that are currently pending. Could you comment on that?
Well, the President has outlined a broad set of principles. Many of the details, of course, are not included in the President's plan. He believes it's his job to lay out a broad set of principles and let Congress work through the very thorny details that must be worked out in a comprehensive package. As you indicated, we do have competing pieces of legislation in the House and the Senate. There are, quite frankly, quite candidly, serious differences. And so it will now be up to a conference committee to work through those differences. Is it going to be easy? I don't think it's going to be easy. But I think it's something that needs to happen. It needs to happen this year because this really is talking about the border security of our country, the national security of our country, the economic security of our country. The President does continue to believe that the momentum is there to get something done this year. We're still hopeful that despite this being an election year, that something can be done. It has to be done for the good of this country.
Another question relates to the cost of the program of reform that the President has put out and whether the massive cost is justified for basic immigration issues or whether we should be increasing the focus on weeding out the terrorist threat.
Well, of course, the actual costs are hard to determine in the abstract. I mean, we have to look at the details of what the Congress ultimately passes. We're focused a lot on the national security of our country. We are spending a lot of money already to protect our country. But you think about the amount of money we spend to secure our airports and to secure our ports. We ought to be spending. We ought to be focusing adequate resources to secure our borders, not just our southern borders, but also our northern borders. And that's something that doesn't get as much attention, which doesn't mean that we don't have a problem on our northern border. We're also working closely with our Canadian counterparts to implement policies and procedures to help secure our northern borders. And so is this going to be inexpensive? No, it's going to be expensive. But that's is what's going to be required to ensure the security of our country. And in a post-9/11 world, it is our number one obligation for those of us in government to ensure that your communities remain safe.
Attorney General Gonzales, I've gotten a number of questions relating to the proposal for identification cards for immigrants. And I wondered if you could talk about the position of the administration on identity cards for all American citizens, and what is the justification for requiring it of immigrants but not of all citizens?
Well, of course, if you're not an American citizen, it's permitted under the Constitution and historically been true that that you don't enjoy all of the benefits that are enjoyed by citizens. And so I think it would be legitimate justification to have special identification cards for those who are not citizens. As a general matter, the administration, I don't believe, has a position on a national ID card. I don't think that's something that the administration has taken a position on. But it seems to me it does make sense for the Congress to consider whether or not it would be appropriate to have some kind of a tamper-proof identification card for non-citizens. One of the problems we're having is that employers are overburdened with the task of trying to identify whether or not the person standing before them is who they say they are and is, in fact, an American citizen. And so we've got to develop a system to make it easier for employers, for people, small businesses, to be able to identify whether or not the person standing before them is who they say they are.
What would you be your view of the proper allocation of funding between the goal of border security and the goal of dealing with the illegal immigrants already here, trying to get them to be naturalized and to become a productive part of the society?
I don't know, if I could articulate to you an appropriate allocation. I do believe that it's very, very important to try to address both those problems. I think some believe that we should be focusing, certainly as an initial matter, maybe solely on border security, and that should be the number one priority and the only priority for the federal government. But I don't think you can have true security for this country without taking into account the 11 to 12 million that are here already illegally. We have to know who they are. We have to know where they're at and why they're here. And so I do think it's appropriate. The president believes it is appropriate that as we look at comprehensive immigration reform, that also takes into account their status, that we provide some kind of legal status so that we take them out of the shadows. And again, we believe that looking at policies or a plan to deal with those that are already here is a very, very important part of securing our country.
Just to follow up on the border efforts, do you have an estimate of the cost of closing the border to perhaps 90% of the current illegal immigration? And could that be achieved by the end of the Bush administration?
I don't know what it would cost. We have a 2,000-mile border with Mexico. We have an open democratic society. Mexico is not an enemy. Mexico is a friend. We have a long tradition of openness with our friends in Mexico. So I don't think that completely closing our border makes any sense for a variety of reasons, some of which I just mentioned. We have to have a comprehensive immigration policy that still allows for the free flow of goods and services so that our economy is not hindered by the immigration policy that is being pursued. And obviously, we have to have a system that recognizes the reality along the border. We have people who have families that live on one side of the border, and they have to be able to travel back and forth daily. Some people have jobs just across the border. And so the immigration policy has to reflect the realities of life along the border. The actual costs, I couldn't even hazard a guess, but this is an important issue, and Congress will make the appropriate decision as to what is the appropriate level of expenditure to focus on each particular aspect of a comprehensive immigration policy.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club, and our guest today is the United States Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. Attorney General Gonzalez, with all of the increased administration that would come about if the president's program were adopted, what changes would be necessary and what would be the approximate cost of expanding the administration to cover the new programs?
Well, we've already, of course, made a lot of changes. The Department of Homeland Security has made securing our borders a key priority. They've already invested a lot of time and energy in looking at identification cards, looking at ways to be more effective in worksite enforcement. In terms of what the ultimate cost of the program is going to be, it's hard for me to say without knowing what the ultimate legislation is going to look like. Again, it's going to cost what it's going to cost to secure our borders, to have a comprehensive plan that makes sense, and that's the key. No one's interested in spending a lot of money for a program that is halfway or that is not effective. That's the challenge that all of us have in government, and that's what you ought to expect as citizens, is that we're focusing on a plan that makes sense, and that is cost-effective, that allows us to protect America, that allows our businesses to continue to have workers, that reflects our values as an open and compassionate society, that respects our understanding that the rule of law must be enforced.
Thank you. I've gotten a number of questions with respect to the government's program of surveillance for the identification of terrorist activities. And I wondered if you might start with giving us a brief overview of the scale and scope of the intervention by the government into private communications under that program and what the legal basis for the government's position would be.
Well, the only program that the government has confirmed is the terrorist surveillance program, which he confirmed last December. And this is a program in which the NSA is engaged in electronic surveillance. It does involve communications where one end of the communication is outside the United States and where a intelligence professional at the National Security Agency has reasonable grounds to believe, probable cause to believe, that one person in the communication is a member or agent of Al-Qaeda or an affiliated organization. terrorist organization. And so that is a program that the president came out to the American people in December and confirmed. It is a program that has been extremely effective. Both Mike Hayden, who is now the director of the CIA, and Bob Mueller, the director of the FBI, have testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee. This has been a very effective program. It has helped us uncover plots that we otherwise would not have uncovered. And the president believes it's a program that needs to continue. The full intel committees of the Senate and the House have now been fully briefed. And we are working on ways to codify some of these authorities. Senator Spector introduced Senator Spector announced legislation to do just that. And so we are engaged now in a dialogue and a discussion with Congress about whether or not legislation is necessary, what that legislation should look like, again, with the objective of ensuring that the President of the United States has the tools that he needs to be exercised in a lawful way to protect America against another attack.
Do you feel that the legal justification for the current activities is questionable?
I don't feel that it's questionable, not at all. I think the President has the authority through the authorization to use military force, which was passed by Congress shortly after the attacks, where the Congress said the President had the authority to use all necessary and appropriate force to confront and defeat this enemy. Those words were interpreted by the Supreme Court in the Hamdi decision of 2004, where the court said those words meant that the President had been given authority by the Congress to engage in those activities which were fundamentally incidental to waging war. There's no question in my mind that electronic surveillance of the enemy during a time of war is something that's been done. It was done by President Wilson during World War I. It was done by President Roosevelt during World War II under similar grants of authority of authorization to use military force and declarations of war during those times of war. Every court that has looked at this issue, every circuit court, and there's not been a Supreme Court decision, but every circuit court that has looked at this issue has said that the President of the United States has the inherent authority under the Constitution to engage in electronic surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes. Every court has said that. And there is a special court of review that reviews the decisions of the FISA court, which is a special court that makes decisions on applications for electronic surveillance. That court of review said that they assume that the President has this inherent authority under the Constitution, and that if that is the case, that FISA, that a statute passed by Congress, could not encroach upon that constitutional authority. We believe the President has the authority under the authorization to use military force. We also believe the President has inherent authority as Commander-in-Chief during a time of war under the Constitution to engage in electronic surveillance of the enemy without a warrant. And we believe that under the circumstances that we've described, such a search is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. As you know, the Fourth Amendment doesn't require that a warrant be obtained in connection with every search. It requires that the search be reasonable. We think a search is reasonable under the circumstances that we've outlined to the American people.
Thank you. There were press reports that the Office of Professional Responsibility of the Justice Department closed an investigation into the domestic surveillance program or the terrorist surveillance program because the department couldn't get clearances to continue the investigation. Can you explain that?
Yes. The Office of Professional Responsibility is an office within the Department of Justice whose job it is solely to evaluate whether or not lawyers have satisfied their basic professional and ethical responsibilities as lawyers in doing their jobs and giving advice. That is the role of this office. And the Office of Professional Responsibility was asked by, I think, 40 Democratic members of Congress to initiate an investigation as to whether lawyers at the Department of Justice did their job in giving legal advice in connection with the terrorist surveillance program. As I've indicated, this is a very important program for the national security of our country. There are only a limited number of people who are read into the program, in other words, officially allowed to have very intimate details of how the program actually operates. The President of the United States decides, because it is such a highly important program, it is the President who decides who is actually read into this program. The President is very concerned about the number of people who have actual information about the program, because the more people that know about the details of the program, the more likely it is that those details become public. And if those details become public, it makes the program program less effective. It informs our enemy about what we're doing, and we believe it makes America less safe. And the president made the decision that it would not be appropriate at this particular time to read in the Office of Professional Responsibility. I might remind people that there is a great deal of oversight that it currently exists with respect to the program already. As I indicated, the full intel committees of the House and Senate have been briefed into the program. They know exactly what we're doing. The Inspector General at the NSA has been involved with this program from virtually the outset. The NSA General Counsel has been involved. There is a monthly meeting of high-level officials at NSA to evaluate what is ongoing under the program to make adjustments if, in fact, steps are being taken that are not totally consistent with the President's authorization. And so there's already a great deal of oversight and review about the scope of this program.
Yesterday, there was a ruling in a court in San Francisco in a case where there was an effort to get access to records of government surveillance. And I wondered what your reaction to that court ruling was.
Well, I've been on the road, so I haven't studied the ruling. Obviously, my understanding is, however, the judge did understand that this was a serious case, and I think left open I think was willing to certify the question for an immediate appeal, understanding that this is this implicates some serious issues for the national security of our country. And so I'll be talking with the Solicitor General and others at the department to evaluate what is the next course of action for the United States government.
There have been some questions about the lawsuits from Colorado and some other states seeking reimbursement from the federal government for the costs imposed on the state by illegal immigration. I wondered if you had a comment on that.
I can understand. The federal government, we ought to be doing our job. We ought to be doing our job in securing our borders, catching people that are crossing our borders illegally and dealing with them. And the reasons why we have these kinds of litigation is because state officials are overburdened. They have been shouldering the burden of capturing undocumented aliens and prosecuting them and then housing them. And they're also overburdened by providing social services to undocumented aliens. And so we understand the frustration. I've had numerous discussions with governors about this. I think we're doing a better job today in dealing with this issue. We need to do a much better job. And hopefully, if we get comprehensive immigration reform legislation passed this year, that'll make us even more effective in dealing with this issue.
I've had some more questions about the border and about Mexico in particular. And one of the questions is, how many terrorists have been captured on the U.S.-Mexican border, and is the allocation of resources on the Mexican border appropriate given the terrorist threat generally in the United States?
The actual number would be a number that would be classified. What I can say is that we do believe that we are spending an appropriate amount of money, and certainly we're paying an appropriate amount of attention. We're very sensitive about terrorists coming in through our southern border. As I indicated before, we're also very sensitive about terrorists that may come in through our northern borders. We had an announcement recently from Canadian authorities about a terrorism group there in Canada. And so it's something that we believe it is appropriate for the United States government to focus on. This is something, however, we cannot be successful without the help of the Mexican government. And so I've had numerous discussions with the President of Mexico, with the Attorney General of Mexico, the Foreign Secretary, the Interior Minister of Mexico, the director of their CIA equivalent, about what they ought to be doing, what they can do to help us. I think it would be helpful as we engage in this debate for the American people to feel comfortable that Mexico understands this is an important issue for us, and that there are things that Mexico can do to help us in this endeavor. And so those conversations will continue. Obviously, we are a sovereign country. They are a sovereign country. We want our borders respected. They want their borders respected. But this issue of immigration reform is one that, quite frankly, is going to require some actions on the part of Mexico and actions by the United States government. And so in order to be effective and dealing with it, we will need to work with the government of Mexico.
Just to follow up on that briefly, obviously one root of the massive influx in the United States of immigrants from Mexico, Central America, and South America is the lack of economic strength and the relative opportunities between the United States and these other countries. What is the approach of the administration to strengthen the economies of our neighbors to the south, and should additional resources be put there as opposed to strengthening defense of certain of the borders of the United States?
Well, obviously, the people coming into our country pursuing a better way of life because conditions and opportunities in Mexico are not as great. We all understand that. And for that reason, in order to make progress, one of the ways we can make progress is to help Mexico in the emergence of a middle class, to provide hope, to provide opportunity in Mexico for its citizens. That's why you have agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA. I think it's very, very important to find ways that we can help the economies in the countries to those treaties, because we need to find people come to this country because they want to pursue a better life, and so if we can work with our friends and allies south of the border, I think that helps us. If we can help them in developing their economies, it obviously, I think, will have an impact in our immigration policies.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club, and our guest today is the United States Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. There's been a lot of debate in the press and on the various sides of the immigration question as to what the cost benefit, the true cost benefit of immigration into the United States is and will be. And I wondered what your comment would be on what you think is the best set of numbers for this and what you think the cost-benefit analysis actually is.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not expert enough in the economics of this to tell you the cost-benefit analysis of immigration reform. Obviously, as I've said repeatedly this morning, we need to have a policy that reflects the fact that immigrants are very, very important to our economy. They're very, very important for many businesses, and so our policy needs to be one that reflects the reality of life currently in our country, and that's the policy that the president believes the Congress ought to be adopting in the law.
In the president's program for immigration reform, what would be the impact on children illegally in the United States? Would they have to pay a penalty in order to become citizens?
That's not something that's directly addressed in the principles the president has laid out, but that is probably one of the more difficult issues that we have to deal with is the children of illegal immigrants. It's an issue that we see every day in states and communities around the country when you have children of immigrants who may happen to be illegally and they graduate, you know, at the top of their high school class, and yet they're denied loans, they're denied access to state universities, and it's a very, very difficult issue. What I can tell you is that the president is very sensitive to this. He believes that even if you're a child of an illegal immigrant, if you're an illegal immigrant who happens to be a child of school age, that you should be entitled to an education in our country. That was his position when he was governor of Texas. It was an issue he dealt with early on as governor of Texas, that he doesn't care how you got here. If you're a child and you're in the state of Texas, my gosh, you're going to get an education. But overall, in terms of how that is ultimately resolved, is an ongoing debate within the Congress.
As the nation's top law enforcement officer, what's your opinion of volunteer border activity by the Minutemen and other militias?
We live in a great and free society, and people can pretty much say what they want to say. They can pretty much go where they want to go, and that's one of the great strengths of our great country. I think the Minutemen are obviously entitled to those kinds of privileges. As a general matter, I think the federal government ought to be the one enforcing the border, enforcing our laws, and where the Minutemen can be helpful. Is that they've got a mighty voice, and I think they ought to be raising those voices in the Congress and telling members of Congress, this is something that's got to be addressed this year. It's got to be addressed now. I understand the frustration that some have experienced with our efforts along the border. The bottom line is we need to do a better job, quite frankly. We have the experience. We have the expertise. The last thing we want to see is someone get killed. Someone get hurt. We don't want to see any kind of confrontation involving the Minutemen. And so, you know, again, we appreciate their efforts in raising the discourse, the profile of this issue, and where they can be helpful is you know, reminding Congress that people in America care about this issue and they need to focus on it.
You know, one of the proposals that the president has come up with is putting the National Guard on the borders, increasing the number of border officers. But much of our illegal immigration is from Asia. And what is the change in the program that would relate to Asian immigration or immigration from shores that are not contiguous with the United States?
I'm not aware of any specific change that is focused solely on Asia. I did talk about changing sort of the catch and release program. I did talk about changes in our policies where, for someone other than Mexico, that if you're captured and we don't have a place to hold you, we simply ask you to come back for a future court date. That is going to change. I can say that.
Let me ask you some questions now about the prisoners in Guantanamo and the recent court rulings that have held that the Geneva Convention status does apply to the detainees, and ask you what your reaction to that change is, and in hindsight, do you believe that the legal precedent support for the government's position before the change was still valid?
Well, that's a complicated question, and I could go on it for quite some time in response to that. The court did not hold that all of Geneva applied to the detainees at Guantanamo. There are a lot of protections afforded under the Geneva Convention. What the court held was that Common Article 3, a provision of all four Geneva Conventions, applies to our conflict with al-Qaeda. That's the first time that a court, that any branch of government of the United States has ever held that international terrorists would be entitled as a matter of law, apparently, to those kind of protections. We respect the court's decision. What that means is that, and all Common Article 3 requires is basic humane treatment. As you may remember, shortly after the attacks of 9/11, the president directed that even though he felt that Common Article 3 did not apply to our conflict with al-Qaeda, that nonetheless the military would treat members of al-Qaeda humanely and subject to military necessity and as appropriate, consistent with the principles of the Geneva Convention. The other thing that the court held was that military commissions, if the president wants to use military commissions, that he must use them using procedures that are uniform with the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And if the president wanted to use procedures that were different from the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that would require congressional action. The court did not say the president could not use military commissions. That's all the court held, was that without congressional action, you have to use procedures that are consistent with the Code of Military Justice. So we are now engaged in a dialogue with the Congress about new procedures to be codified by the Congress. My sense is that a majority of the members of Congress believe that military commissions should remain a tool for the President of the United States. We have to find a way to bring these terrorists to justice. And so my sense is that we will reach an agreement on legislation which will codify procedures for military commissions, and those commissions will continue to remain a tool for Commander-in-Chief for this war.
Do you believe that there has been damage to the American reputation abroad as a country that abides by law and by proper protection of all human beings with respect to the way we have treated the prisoners at Guantanamo?
I think that it's interesting. There's a lot of misinformation and misperception about detainee treatment at Guantanamo. I think there was a delegation from Belgium recently that went down to Guantanamo, and they came away, I don't want to say singing the praises, but they were very surprised at the humane conditions that exist at Guantanamo. There are many critics of the president who have gone to Guantanamo and have come back saying, you know, what we're doing down at Guantanamo is actually quite humane, and people feel very, very comfortable about the humane treatment. Unfortunately, Guantanamo has become a symbol. people who want to criticize the administration or critical of the president, they have fastened on Guantanamo as a symbol to attack. And it has presented problems for the United States. And so whether those perceptions are right or wrong, it creates difficulties for us. For us to be successful in fighting this war successfully, we need the help of our friends and allies around the world. And so if they're feeling pressure from their own populations, it creates difficulties for us. And it is for that reason that the president did talk about closing Guantanamo at the appropriate point. You have to remember, we capture people on the battlefield fighting against our men and women in uniform. And when we capture them, we have to do something with them. We could release them, I suppose, but I'm not sure that would be very smart. We could return them back to their home country, I suppose, but then if they immediately join the battlefield, I'm not sure how that's in America's interest either. So that's why Guantanamo was established in the first place, as a place to hold these people. And we have many procedures in place to ensure that before someone even comes over to Guantanamo, we feel comfortable that they are in fact enemy combatants. And when they come to Guantanamo, they receive a process called a combatant status review tribunal, which evaluates whether or not they are in fact an enemy combatant. And then every year they get another review, like a parole review someone would receive in this country, to evaluate whether or not they should continue to remain in Guantanamo. People don't understand that there is more process given to Guantanamo detainees than has ever been received by anyone under the Geneva Conventions. And the other thing that I want all of you to understand is that there have been at least 12 to 15 people who we've held at Guantanamo. We released because we felt that they no longer had intelligence value and no longer posed a threat to America. And then we later discovered that they were fighting against our men and women. And so what do we tell a mother or father whose son or daughter is killed by someone we once held at Guantanamo? These are very, very difficult issues. Nonetheless, you know, the president is committed to ensuring that we're doing everything we lawfully can, and then we're doing everything that is effective in protecting America. And, you know, at the appropriate time, Guantanamo is going to close, but we need to pursue a course of action that does not compromise the security of our country, does not compromise the safety of our men and women fighting terrorism.
In hindsight, is there anything we should have done differently, and is there anything we should do in another way going forward with respect to combatants in this situation?
Well, clearly mistakes, in a time of war, sometimes decisions have to be made quickly. You have to understand that decisions relating to military commissions, for example, were made just shortly after the attacks of 9/11. We didn't know whether or not there was going to be another attack. We didn't know about this. What kind of enemy were we fighting? This was a new kind of enemy in a new kind of war. And so we've learned along the way. I think in many cases the positions of the administration have been challenged. I would say in a great majority of the cases the courts have sustained the decisions made by the president. In other cases, the courts have disagreed. And when they've disagreed, we conform our conduct accordingly. And that's because that's the kind of country that we live in. We operate under the rule of law. And the best that we can do, all of us can do, in terms of making decisions during a time of war, is evaluate what the courts have told us in the past and make our decisions based on those precedents. And, we act in good faith to ensure that we're doing everything we can do within the law, within the Constitution, to protect America.
You know, one of the strong principles of the Bush administration is the respect for state sovereignty. And I wondered how you would justify the federal response to the Oregon Death with Dignity Act in light of the need to protect state sovereignty.
Well, that was a decision that was made before my time as Attorney General as an initial matter. I don't know if I want to give an answer beyond the fact of saying that maybe it's because of my experiences as an initial matter in government, of being in state government, where I as a personal matter, believe that on most issues, the people closest to the issue, the government, state governments and local governments, quite frankly, know best what is effective, what works. I think, you know, power is reserved to them. And, there are certain kinds of issues like fighting terrorism, like immigration, which cross borders, and where it is appropriate to have the federal government involved. So I'll just give you sort of my general views about federalism and state sovereignty, which, you know, I very much believe in.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question, and this is one that I would expect you to have some personal feelings about it, and that is, in the debate on immigration policy, there have been comments or overtones of racism at times, and I wondered if you thought that any of the approaches that are being put forward are influenced by that, and what should be our reaction to root that out and to make sure that we are not enforcing racist policies in this country?
Well, obviously, we should all be sensitive to the fact that whether you're illegal or not, you're entitled to certain basic respect, and that I've had concerns. I've had leaders of national Hispanic groups talk to me about various cases around the country where Hispanics have been assaulted and concerns raised that because of the immigration debate that perhaps Hispanics are being targeted. And that, of course, is of great concern to me. I've had numerous conversations with the head of our civil rights division to focus on those kind of cases. As a general matter, we defer to the state and locals to prosecute those cases first, and then we defer to the actions of state and locals. But you raise a very good point, and that is, as we move forward, the debate has to be one of respect. It's got to be a civil debate about what is the right course of action. It's got to be one that respects human basic dignity. And I'm very confident. Again, I remain optimistic. I remain confident that we can get something done this year because we have to.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for your candid and informative remarks. We are most grateful that you have chosen to grace our podium with your presence today. We also thank our outstanding moderator, Mary Cranston, the firm chair of the law firm of Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, and Pittman. We thank the Toby Family American Value Series. We thank our audience here today in Santa Clara, California, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is now adjourned.